Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, this is Seasoned. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. Usually, we're telling you to hug a farmer, but this hour, we want you to hug your local librarian. National Library Week is coming up, and so the Seasoned team is celebrating how libraries connect with communities through food and drink. Coming up, a Middletown librarian pairs wine with books. She'll make some recommendations for both. Later in the show, I talk with librarians from Durham about how their food programs engage teenagers. And you'll learn about the surprising things you can borrow from the library. I'm not just talking about books here, but fun-themed cake pans, mixers, air fryers, and rice cookers, too. But first, the downtown branch of the Hartford Public Library may be closed for renovations, but that hasn't stopped our first guests from setting up shop there. Andrea Hawkins and Doug Barber are the owners of Birkin's Blend Cafe in Glastonbury, and their new shop, Birkin's on Main, is on the first floor of the Hartford Public Library. That's where producer Catrice Claudio spoke to the couple about what it means to them to have their coffee shop within the Hartford Public Library.
Welcome, Andrea and Doug. Thank you for talking with me this morning. I'm excited to talk about Birkin's Blend, this new move in Hartford Public Library, which is such a dope idea and such a dope concept. Can you tell us a little bit more about the mashup of the name? How did we come Birkin's?
Thank you so much for inviting us. We're really excited to be here and having this conversation with you today. So thank you. So Birkin's, it is a mashup of our last names. So Doug's last name is Barber, mine is Hawkins. We took Burr and Kins, squished it together, and that's how we came up with Birkin's.
Can you talk more about your roots in Hartford and why we chose the city?
Yeah, so I was here since I was 2 years old, and I'm not 2 years old anymore. I'm 58, almost 59. I grew up here in Hartford. I grew up in the projects. My mother was a single parent. She had my brother and I. By the time she was 22, she left Harlem, where we were born, and came here by herself with two little babies. And I went to McDonough School. I went to Hartford High School. I went to Our Lady of Sorrows. I'm from this community.
Me too. I went to OLS.
You went
to OLS.
Oh my gosh. Look at that. So I am of this community. I have served this community. I went to Greater Hartford Community College in this community. Went to Central and University of Hartford. So I am of this community. And I met this cutie pie at church on Sterling Street in Hartford. And I'll let him tell you a little bit about the church.
Yeah, so I grew up in East Windsor, but my family's church was here in Hartford on Sterling Street. It's a Pentecostal church, so we spent a lot of time in church over on Sterling Street. And in the 90s, we moved to East Windsor, but it's still there. We still have family here in Hartford. Hartford is still home. My first job out of college was here in Hartford. And so, yeah, that's my roots here in Hartford.
For people who haven't been here yet, is it possible you can describe the space, the vibe of Birkin's on Main?
The first thing I would say is, you know, just looking around here, it's so full of light because there are so many windows. And every time I walk into the space, I just feel like going, so it just feels so glorious being in this space. And the wonderful thing is that it looks right out onto Main Street. And furthermore, past Main Street, you can actually see a little corner of Bushnell Park. So I feel like it brings this Hartford community right into this cafe. And that is my favorite part.
Yeah, I echo that. The light, the access to the community. We want them to see us. We want them to feel welcome here when they walk in. When they see us on the street, we want it to be a community space. So that's my favorite part.
I do agree. It's very spacious, very gorgeous, super. If you are an Instagram girly, the aesthetics are nuts out here. So please bring your cameras on. Libraries today are so much more than just books. How does this coffee shop help us rethink the roles of libraries in the community?
Right. It's not just about books. I mean, I think about having been in this community. I served the Amistad Center for Art and Culture, which is located in the Wadsworth Athenaeum, which is two buildings away from this building. And I think about the collaborative programs that we even did at the Amistad Center with the library. There's really something special about that collaboration where we are all trying to teach and we're trying to build culture and we're trying to create a space where everyone can feel like they belong. And so this library does all of that independently, like by itself. So to be here is just such an opportunity when we think about everything that this library does. And I can't tell you, we've been open here since December 21st, which is only a few months now. And every single day, even today, people come here. They want to make copies. They are looking for the job center. They're looking for how to learn how to speak English. They are looking for a program that they want to be a part of. So it's more than books, right? They're disappointed that they don't have access to the computers right now while they're doing the renovations. So there's so many things that we even found out about just by being here that we didn't even necessarily know the library was up to. So amazing things happening here.
You mentioned something about like libraries being more than just a place for books and being a hub for more of the community needs and supporting those needs. And I also have noticed that Birkin's Blend does a lot with the arts. Can you talk more about how you guys uplift the arts here as a coffee shop in the library?
We have a ton of art that we have amassed over time. Just, I would say my love of art, it came from my connection to the Amistad Center. And so there are just a lot of connections. And because when you grow up here, you meet a lot of people. I know some amazing artists that are like internationally recognized. You know, I think about, you know, Edgenetta Miller, who's a famous quilter. She lives right in the north end of Hartford, and she is one of the loveliest people. Ellis Echeverria, Donald Boudreau, Andre Rochester. And when you grow up in this community, they come and they support you. You support them.
So I saw on the door, you have the Baby Grand Jazzy event. I knew prior to the library move, you had these infamous brunches.
Yes.
And it was always a vibe. The food was always being raved about on my timeline, at least. And so, Doug, as the coffee lover of the group, the person who's absolutely in love with the culture, can you tell us more about what we can expect when we get the coffee here?
So the coffee is my favorite blend. So it's a proprietary blend. We have a roaster that we picked out the beans, we picked out the blend, and so now we exclusively serve our blend. There's a lot of good coffee out there in the world, and so we created a blend that I think people really enjoy, and it's got a much more West Coast feel to it than most of the coffee that you'll find in the surrounding area. So that's kind of our differentiator, if you will.
Can you break that down for us? What is the flavor of Birkin's Blend?
So medium roasted coffee. And we do the medium roast because it doesn't impart as much bitter. The longer you roast a coffee, the more bitterness it imparts. So it's medium roasted and it's a blend of coffees from around the world. So it gives us that bold flavor that we're looking for, that a lot of folks are looking for, a nice robust flavor without that bitterness at the end. So it is kind of a nice silky smooth finish to a nice, robust cup of coffee.
So I'm going to deviate a little bit because, you know, coffee shops are not just for coffee drinkers. We have a wonderful tea selection. You have mushroom coffee here. Tell me more about the tea blends because it's not simple black, green, regular.
So my wife doesn't drink coffee, to my chagrin. But she wanted to make sure we had special teas. So I'm going to let you talk about the teas.
Right. I love Doug. Doug loves coffee. That is my whole connection to the coffee. But I do love tea. And so, yes, we do have a beautiful selection of teas. And we have herbal teas and we have caffeinated teas. And for those of you that don't know, an herbal tea doesn't have caffeine. I have a little bit of a caffeine sensitivity. And I like to say that I think God naturally caffeinated my blood. But yeah, we do have a nice selection. And from time to time, we get notes on our Facebook page. I know when we were opening here, someone said, please, please, please carry Darjeeling tea. It's like, absolutely. And so we ordered Darjeeling tea and now they come in and order Darjeeling. So I love to try new flavors. So I'm always curious when people want something new. It's a good opportunity.
I don't know if the mic has been hearing me slam my cup down on the table, but I'm currently sipping a Chinese tea with the bergamot and a splash of vanilla if anybody's interested in trying it. So, so out of 168 cities in Connecticut, you chose Hartford. What was it about being here? What did it mean for you to have a location here in the community?
There's something about the vibe of the city, right? And there's something about the opportunity that we think hasn't even been fully realized. And we want to be a part of, as the community continues to evolve, and I know that it is, I can see that it is, we want to be that space where people say, oh, let's meet at Birkin's, and know that they're going to come in and feel completely welcome and feel comfortable, and that we're going to go out of our way to make sure that they have everything that they could possibly want out of a cafe. So what would you add?
I think it creating spaces for people like us, people of color, to have a place that they can comfortably come and call their own, call home base, to meet up with friends, to meet groups for business, to just come in by themselves and get some quiet time. We just want to create a space. And so each of our spaces, we try to do a little bit of that, make sure that we had some quiet, cozy spaces for those people that need the solitude, mm-hmm. and then our larger community tables for those folks that like to meet and be together.
With Birkin's being a hub for not only good coffee, but culture, how else does this space serve the community at large?
We're excited because it also has a space where you can be outside too. There's a little patio right outside of the doorway where I imagine live music and food and drinks and just being right out there in the open air. So it really is a fantastic venue for any event that you can imagine.
It's exciting to think about the potential of what you guys are doing in this space, what the library is offering as a community space as well. So we talk about the energy of the library and the people it attracts. And right now, the library is under construction, the renovation, and yet there's still a buzz that is coming from this being in the library. What has your experience in the library and this partnership been?
It really has been amazing. And they ask us often, how are things going? Are people coming in? What can we do? To have the support that we're receiving from them is really quite amazing. And we're really, really grateful for that.
And we're looking forward to when the library opens, all of the programming that we can do together in collaboration that will come in the future.
Gotta love the cohesion. Thank you so much, Andrea and Doug, for talking with us today about your shop, the library, and your relationship with the community as a result of being in that partnership. It's been amazing speaking with you, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This was great.
That was Catrice Claudio at Birkin's on Main with Andrea Hawkins and Doug Barber. In the very near future, they hope to host events at their space, like viewing parties, family celebrations, and even small weddings. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. After a short break, you'll meet a librarian who pairs wine with books.
With the funkiness of her character, the funkiness of the cover art, I had to choose a funky wine.
This is Seasoned. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Walk across the courtyard. towards the library.
Welcome back to Seasoned, everyone. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. This hour, we're celebrating National Library Week. My next guest is a wine enthusiast and librarian in Middletown.
My name is Shannon Barilleri. I work here at Russell Library, and I am the director of the Digital Emerging Technologies Department.
She's also the author of the library's blog, Wine and Words. Her posts pair wine with books from the library's shelves. As a young adult, she worked at a local boutique wine shop in Glastonbury, owned by a family friend. And she immersed herself in wine culture and read everything she could get her hands on. Maybe not surprising for a librarian, right?
I started at a young age, so 21. And that's when I started buying the $10 bottles and just kind of trying different things and being exposed to like this whole industry of taste. And taste is a sense that I feel like I wish people acknowledged a little bit more, because there's so many fun things that you can do with it. And everything with wine, being it just smelling it and then moving to your taste, is what gives it its essence. But there's so much more to that. So you can start with that, because that's the premise of what it is. It's something to drink. But then there's always a fun backstory. There's always a history behind it and how this wine came to be, how it was made, the family who made it. So that's kind of like my historian aspect to it. And there's always something new to learn when it comes to wine. There's new varietals that come out. There's varietals that are coming back. There's new wine producers. There's new winemakers. And there's a lot of amazing female winemakers that are coming to the forefront right now in the wine industry. But it's just a constant learning experience. And being a librarian and a lifelong learner coincides with my love of wine, because you're always learning and you always get to have a fun little taste of something at the end of it too.
Tell me what inspired you to start a blog at the library where you pair wine with books.
I'm bringing two of my favorite things together, but also the act of picking out wines for people and picking out books for people. When I was working at the wine store, one of my favorite things to do was having a customer walk in and ask me, I'm having this and this for dinner, what wine do you think would be good? And I would give them a couple different options, you know, what's the price point, red or white, and come to a decision. Because working with wine, you have to try a lot of the wine. So you have to know what you're going to offer to people. It's a connection between you and another person. And then they come back into the store saying, that was a great wine, you know, give me something else. And working at a library, I love conducting reader advisory.
And that's just picking books for people,
and
right?
That's picking
matching
books.
People with books.
Exactly. So it's a reference question in a way. You kind of have to peel back the layers. Like, what are you looking for? So you have to ask the right kinds of questions. And I'm just doing it through the blog instead. So I'm picking out a really wonderful, sometimes affordable wine that I think, and pairing it with a fascinating book to read.
Yeah, and if the people of Middletown don't know yet that they can come into their library and get a book and a wine recommendation, and I think it's like the most fun thing and like quite a little service you're providing with this blog.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a lot of fun writing it.
How do you go about pairing a book with a wine?
I read the book through and through, and while reading, I start understanding like the different characters, getting the plot down, how words are chosen, the covers of the book. So all of that is percolating. Then I sit at the wine store and just kind of look at a wall of wine. Before even going there, I'm going to understand, is it a white wine? Is it a rosé? Is it a red? Is it a sparkling? For example, one of the books, which was called The Guest by Emma Klein, the cover art was green and blue. It was like very funky. The character herself was, you could say, unique to say the least. She's very vague, but also very endearing. So with the funkiness of her character, the funkiness of the cover art, I had to choose a funky wine. When I think of funky wines, I think of natural wines, and which is the one I did choose. So it all kind of interplays with each other. So the wine, pardon, my pronunciation is not always the best.
That's okay.
So it's from the producer Korbal, and it's a Slovenian wine, and the wine is Bata, I believe. Mm-hmm. But it's a funky, fun, fizzy thing to drink, and it's just fun to drink while reading that book. It just kind of what inspires me. Mm. You start researching the wine a little bit more, and then you try and pull the different characteristics, not only from maybe what the taste of the wine is, but maybe where the wine comes from, maybe the background story of the wine from the families that produce it. There's so many different components that go into it, and I try and weave it in a nice, fluid way. So you're learning something about wine, but also getting a fun book review at the same time.
Yeah. Now, talk me through one of your most recent pairings. It's a wine from the Rhone Valley in France, mm-hmm. and you paired it with the biography Kerouac by Anne Charters. And she's from Connecticut, by the way, former professor at UConn. Tell me how that pairing came to you.
So this was a little tough. Kerouac is a little bit of a lush. And the wine that I picked, it was brand new into the store. So it's kind of a little bit off the beaten path. In this region, it's mostly known for Muscadet grapes in, I'm going to butcher this, Boumets de Venise. This is in Southern Rhone. So in Southern Rhone, the main grapes are Syrah, Mourvèdre, and Grenache. Mm-hmm. This wine specifically is Grenache and Syrah. So Muscadet, the grapes that are known for that region, they're kind of like big, sweet white wines. And now they've started taking it a little bit more seriously. Since they're taking it seriously, maybe more people are going to take Kerouac seriously and see him as a great writer, while this kind of off-the-beaten-path wine is going to be a great wine as well. Looking at it, I was looking at how Anne Charters kind of brought light to what a sensitive man Kerouac was and how he was just kind of a lost soul finding his way through life. And I think this wine is finding its pathway as well.
Oh, I love that.
Both together on the road.
Yeah. You gave the wine a whole backstory, too.
I tried.
So another example that I wanted to ask about, you love Beaujolais, both the grape varietal and the region in France. Tell me how you landed on pairing a Beaujolais with both Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina. Lots of people will know these novels, so go ahead.
Yes. How I ended up pairing this Beaujolais Chateau Thivin with them is that the main grape of Beaujolais is Gamay. And a Gamay, it's a fragile grape. It needs a lot of attentive care. And the two female protagonists, Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina, they're sensitive women. Society doesn't treat them very nicely at all, as we all know in both of these novels. It's very tragic, actually, what happens. I kind of was more thinking of how the grape compares to both of these women, and that it not only the grape needs the attentive care, but so do these two female characters. And so I chose one of my favorite Beaujolais. This was one of my first, like, a little expensive wines that I bought when I was growing and learning more about wine that I splurged on. And let me tell you, it is completely worth it. The producer of this is Kermit Lynch. If you don't know Kermit Lynch, I also bring him up in another one of my posts. He is kind of the man who revolutionized the wine industry in the United States. So he was bringing so many different small family producers from Italy and France and really around the globe to America at the time. And that's why we get a lot of the cool wines we do today. And his name is on all of them. But I think the grape is the essence of these two characters. I also picked a wine that I remember this family has been around since the 1800s who have been producing this wine and in which both of these books were written.
So I learned a lot about small wine producers in Italy and France from your pairings. And I love when you give the backstory of a vineyard or an estate where one of your picks is harvested and made. It's always good to know where your food and drink comes from. So why do you think it's important to highlight some of the family stories behind the wines that you choose to pair with books?
It's highlighting something that I don't think everybody knows. When they're small family producers, you have to search for them a little bit. And usually they have such a wonderful story to tell because their winemaking goes back generations. And it's a beautiful form of art. being able to expose it and share it with people. That's the fun part about wine.
Yeah, and people should know too that just because it is a small farm or a small producer and it's not a mass-produced wine, it doesn't always mean that it's more expensive. You can get a great $10 or $15 bottle of wine that just happens to come from a small producer in France or Italy, and it's worth taking a risk on.
Yes, they're just fun.
In traditional wine pairing, food makes the wine better and the wine makes the food better. How do you think wine might enhance the reading experience? So what do you hope that readers gain from the sensory interplay between literature and wine?
Think about when you're reading. You are using a lot of your senses. So you're touching the book, you're smelling the book. Might have a faint smell if it's a local library book or from a used bookstore.
Yeah, that's right. It's unmistakable.
Exactly. You are seeing the words. Or if you're listening to an audiobook, you're listening.
Yeah.
So the one thing that you're not doing in any type of reading experience is tasting. By bringing in a wine that aligns with the book is bringing in that other sense that's not being used. And I hope that with readers, they take one of my wines that I've decided and read the book, and maybe they see something new, or they can pair it with a different wine, or they start pairing wines with different books and bringing light to something new. I think it's just one of the senses that's not being used, and now it's integrated. Mm. So have that beautiful glass of red while you're in your reading chair, and now you're using all your senses. And let's hope there's some fun music playing in the background, too.
Yeah. It sort of makes me think of almost like when I'm on vacation is a time when I read for pleasure. And then also maybe there's like a glass of rosé or something happening at the same time. And like that experience, those are two things that you're doing like for pleasure. And it puts me in a vacation space.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. You made me think of that.
Oh, I'm so glad.
But sometimes a good book begs for a good stiff drink. So tell me about your pairing for the Teddy Roosevelt biography, The Last Romantic, by historian H.W. Brands. What was that all about?
Funny story. My sister and I were sitting having a drink at Osa here in Middletown. And,
great restaurant.
Great restaurant.
Yes.
I'm like, so I'm writing my blog. I can't pair wine with Teddy. And she said, no, you can't. She's like, you need to do a whiskey. And so I chose Elijah Craig for the whiskey. Mm-hmm. And I had to choose something that Teddy possibly could have drank. They put it right on their label, 1789, American born and bred bourbon. So bourbon is under the whiskey umbrella. The whiskey umbrella is huge.
Yeah.
So there's bourbon, there's American whiskey, there's Irish whiskey, there's Scotch, there's Japanese whiskey. So a lot of that pairing went into what something Teddy could have possibly drank, what is something I really like. It just being like something that puts hair on your chest. Because that's the kind of man that he was. Like, I think he fought a bear, literally. Some of the events of his life are completely outrageous and fascinating at the same time. He's one of my favorite presidents. He's just a character.
Not someone that you would think about in the same vein as like a delicate wine.
Not at all. So you couldn't pair a wine with him.
No. Nope.
So it had to be a good, strong whiskey. Which Elijah Craig, it's really quite delicious. Take one in hand and enjoy.
What made Bubbly the perfect pairing for Virginia Woolf's Orlando? So tell me a little bit about that novel and a little bit about this Cremant that you love.
So Orlando, it is not what you think when you think of Virginia Woolf. People tend to have a solemn, grim outlook, or it's going to be a sad novel, in which Orlando's not. It's a very fun, whimsical novel. Yes, there is Virginia Woolf with her. There's definitely feministic undertones, because the whole premise of the book is this young man becomes a woman overnight, then doesn't age for 300 years. So just even that point, I don't even want to call it magical realism. It is a little bit kind of science fiction-y and fantasy, but you get to meet all these interesting people throughout the time period that Orlando travels through. It's a very fun book, and she writes so poetically and endearing. It is absolutely beautiful. The quotes that come from this novel, like, memory is a seamstress, You don't think of it that way, but her play on words, just outstanding. So with it being, I think, a very fun, whimsical novel, I had to pair just a fun, pretty bubbly wine that goes with it. So the Cremant that we have today is the Baudet Herold. I chose it because I'm like, well, we have to do a bubble and make it fun. But then the label itself kind of helped inspire the pairing as well. It's elegantly done with nice floral designs on it that kind of wrap around the wording, which played within the novel itself, I think.
So tell me about the grape in this.
It's mostly Chenin Blanc. This is a wonderful wine, very interesting, intricate. Orlando is a bit intricate at the same time. There's a lot of interesting characteristics that apply to them that develop over time as you get to know them in the novel.
Shannon, thank you so much for showing me around the library, and thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you for this today. This has been wonderful.
That was librarian Shannon Barilleri. She's the director of Digital Emerging Technologies at the Russell Library in Middletown. You can see photos of Shannon and some of the books and wines from her blog on our show page, ctpublic.org/seasoned. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. After a short break, I talk with librarians in Durham who are engaging their community with the library through food.
Food is very social and it's very cultural. So it's the kind of thing that a lot of people, I think, get excited about participating in and discussing.
You're listening to Seasoned on Connecticut Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Helps me find Hemingway, helps me find Genet, helps me find Brett, helps me find Chandler, helps me find James Joyce. She always makes the right choice. She's no queen.
Love in the library, quiet and cool. Love in the library, there are no rules. Surrounded by stories surreal and sublime, I fell in love in the library.
Welcome back to Seasoned. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. This hour, we're loving on our local librarians. You've been part of a book club, right? How about a cookbook club? Next up, meet two librarians from the Durham Public Library who use food programs to connect people with the library and with each other. Youth Services Librarian Kristen Slepecki runs the Teen Test Kitchen program. That's where teenagers participate in fun taste tests and make edible experiments. And library director Christine Michaud leads Cookbook Club.
So our Cookbook Club meets once a month, 8 times a year. It's new, and it's a club where we discuss cookbooks and try food. So it's a combination of book discussion and potluck lunch.
Love it. Sounds like a party.
It is fun. Our tagline is actually growing knowledge and community. And the Cookbook Club in particular seemed to be a really good fit for both a book-focused and a community-focused event. And the Cookbook Club had kind of been in the back of my mind for a while, so we decided to give it a try.
So it wasn't just a ruse to get the good people of Durham to bring you lunch.
That is working out brilliantly. I am getting some wonderful lunches out of the deal. So yeah, it's a side bonus, I guess.
Yeah. Describe the members. Who's coming? Is it a mix of people or is it the older folks that you serve here?
It is a mix of people. I'd say the majority of our participants are retired, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. We do have a couple of younger people who come. We've gotten some people who don't come to other programs, which is really fun and nice to see.
Oh, so you mean like the Cookbook Club is the thing that gets them in the door of the library? It's a gateway.
Yes, we hope to be.
I understand that the loneliness epidemic was something that was in the back of your mind when you were thinking about creating this club. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, it was. You may be aware that the Surgeon General of the United States has actually identified loneliness as an epidemic that has health implications for people. there's been some discussion in library circles about how libraries can work to address that, because libraries are well positioned for that. They're already free and open to the public and have programs and events that people get together. That discussion did lead me to think more specifically about the kind of programs that people don't just listen to an educational talk, but actually get to participate. And, you know, food is very social and it's very cultural. So it's the kind of thing that a lot of people, I think, get excited about participating in and discussing. And having a meal together is one of the more fundamental social interactions that people have. I very much wanted to have food. Some cookbook clubs, people prepare food at home, but then they just get together and talk about the book. And I was like, that doesn't sound any fun. We want to eat.
Yes.
It's interesting because at our February meeting, some of the participants in the club actually brought that up, not prompted by me, but that it's hard to meet people, especially once a lot of us met our friends when, you know, our kids were in school. But when you're older, the kids are grown, you're not spending your time at the side of ball fields and stuff like that. And they were appreciative that they were meeting new people and talking to new people. And they're even making connections outside. At our last meeting, there's a community garden in Durham that some of the people who are in the cookbook club participate in. And discussion turned to that. And now some other people are volunteering to go help out at the community garden. So it's a really lovely way of building community.
Yeah, I love that. I think what you're doing here is so important.
Thanks. I do think that it is important in a small way, and it's fun too.
You've launched this session of Cookbook Club around the theme of everyday cooking. So what books have you done so far, and what are folks making?
So the first one was Smitten Kitchen Every Day by Deb Perlman.
Love her.
And the second one was Everyday Italian by Giada De Laurentiis. The last one we did was Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook by Dory Greenspan.
Yeah, and lives in Connecticut. She's local.
I didn't actually know that. That's yeah. Fantastic.
Well, she lives in Connecticut and Paris.
That sounds fantastic.
It does.
And the last cookbook in the Everyday series we're going to be doing next month is More Mexican Every Day by Rick Bayless. And I have to say that our participants very much thought that Dory's Every Day was perhaps a little aspirational for us.
Yeah.
They were a little...
For the average home cook.
They weren't really a get home from work and throw it together kind of mm-hmm. thing. Delicious, but more of a weekend kind yeah. of cooking than every day.
I love that discovery that they made.
Yeah, it's made for some interesting discussion, because when we meet, we eat, obviously. Mm-hmm. But then we go around the table and talk about, you know, what we liked about the cookbook, what we didn't like, how we came to choose the recipes that people made, how the recipe worked out. We have had some discussion about cooking techniques and certainly sharing of tips and favorite ingredients. One of our participants brought some sourdough starter to share with one of our other participants.
Oh,
so apparently this sourdough bread will be growing through Durham. It makes for a different kind of book discussion because there's not really a plot. Although some of the cookbooks really do have stories.
Yes.
Some cookbooks are very, you know, recipe focused, but a lot of them do have some... how this recipe came about or the family history behind it. Or there's even a trend of kind of half cookbook, half memoir.
Absolutely.
Now, we haven't done any of those so far, but that is a bit of a trend in cookbook memoirs.
Yeah. I especially love when the recipe has like a great backstory or there's a family story behind it. And it could really be a springboard for people talking about perhaps maybe who taught them how to cook. And it's great fodder for connecting somehow.
Yes. And that has come up in our discussions of, you know, we've had conversations about learning to cook from grandparents and how... One of the recipes in Everyday Dory that somebody made was a stuffed cabbage. And that brought up memories of grandparents who had made that in cultural recipes. there's so many cultural traditions around food. I mean, every culture has its food ways and food cultures and what you learned and what you didn't learn and who taught you, which really comes out as part of this discussion.
Yeah. Kristen, tell me about how you have managed to get a group of teenagers to come to the library once a month to play with their food.
I bribe them with food.
Yeah, that's how you do it, right?
Yes.
There'll be treats, everyone.
Yes. Sugary treats are for sure the way to go. Yeah, we've had food programs for teens for a while. This year, I leaned heavily into the STEAM component, the science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. We've done experiments, like we made bubble gum in January, and it was an absolute failure. It did not work at all, but we had a lot of fun, and we were able to talk about what maybe went wrong, what we could change for next time, whether they'd try it at home, which some of them were eager to do, what different flavors we could try. We really did a scientific process with the whole thing. It was an experiment.
Yeah, yeah. Teenagers love now making slime. Gum is just slime you can eat.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And we have made some edible slime mixed success. You can make slime out of Peeps. Fun fact.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yep. It's just marshmallow. You throw them in the microwave and mix it with some cornstarch, and it stretches really good. It's just really sticky. So yeah, got to be prepared for the sticky factor. They've really been enjoying the science component. We did a couple taste tests. We're doing unicorn dip, which sounds so gross, but it's just multicolored marshmallowy cream cheesy dip thing. That's going to be a fun one.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from your teenagers? What are they saying to you? Or are they too cool for school in that way where, like, you know, they love the program, but they're not coming up to you being like, this was the highlight of my week.
They love it. They come in and they chat with me the entire, which is another part of why I do it and why we love doing it. They come in and they talk to me. They actually have given me many ideas for future food programs, the kinds of things they want to make, which takes a lot of work off my plate. And that's great. It's been awesome.
I was wondering, is the loneliness epidemic something that you think about too as you develop topics for your teen test kitchen? Or is it more just about giving the teenagers who have experienced a few years of Zoom school an opportunity to practice their social interaction and connection?
Both. Kids right now are very connected to each other with technology. They text all the time. They're video chatting all the time. They're on social media. They're not necessarily getting together in person, either with their peers or with trusted adults. And it's so important to have a place for them to come, a reason for them to come. I mean, we have our doors open to them after school every day, and some do take advantage of that and they come here. Some kids don't. They're not able to walk from school. They're not able to come after school. They have activities. So the programs at night are really helpful to make sure they have a place where they can come and be welcome and be with other kids.
Thank you so much, both of you, for talking with me about your cookbook club and the teen program that you have here. It was a joy to speak with you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
That was Christine Michaud and Kristen Slepecki of the Durham Public Library. Before we go, did you know that your local library could help with dinner tonight? Some libraries are fortunate enough to have a library of things. I've asked my next guest librarian to give us the scoop.
My name is Bridget Quinn. I am the president and CEO of the Hartford Public Library.
Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So for people who don't know, can you describe what the library of things is?
Well, it is a library of stuff. I mean, we have items that people can borrow, things like blood pressure monitors or fishing poles or sewing machines. They are real things that people can borrow with their library card to take and use at home.
What are some of the things that people with a Hartford Public Library card can borrow that they can use to improve or just use in their cooking?
There is lots of stuff. In fact, this is one of the areas of the library of things that I think is super, super popular. It's only one of the kinds of items that we have, but we have things like baking trays and air fryers and hand mixers and cake decorating sets and cake pans, different shapes. Those are really popular because, as you can imagine, you don't need to have a million different shapes of cake pans. Sometimes you just want a specific one. You can just borrow it and then bring it back. That's the most wonderful thing.
You're only going to make that Darth Vader cake for 1 year of your kid's birthday.
Exactly.
And they can be expensive.
Yeah. Oh, they can. And that's the nice thing, too, is that it enables people not to have to expend money on things that they're only going to use once or use occasionally. And they just borrow it and bring it back.
Yeah. I have to admit something. A friend gave me an Instant Pot a few years ago, and when it started collecting dust and taking up precious cabinet space that I could no longer justify, I gave it away. But is it true that a person can borrow an Instant Pot from the Hartford Public Library?
You can borrow an Instant Pot. So when that mood strikes you, yes, just come in and grab one from one of the library branches.
I'm going to need to maybe get a cookbook, too, that's an Instant Pot one.
We might have a few of those laying around as well.
Or a dozen.
Yeah.
When people borrow special cake pans or cookie cutters or the cake decorating sets, do the librarians sometimes get a little bit of a story to go along with it? Like, are you privy to all the holiday cookie platters and special birthday parties being planned? Like, all the fun stuff that people do with the stuff they get from the Library of Things?
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the real joy of working at the libraries, having those kinds of conversations and sharing stories with our customers. And every once in a while, the library staff will even get something, an actual treat from a customer that had a really successful baking episode or use them to make stuff for the library staff, which is even more special.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So people bring the things back, and sometimes there's a little treat there.
We like that when that happens.
Definitely. The perks of being a librarian.
Exactly.
So aside from the Library of Things, are there other ways that the library helps cooks, aside from having, shelves full of cookbooks about 30-minute meals or having books that cover every cuisine known to man? Like, what else can cooks look for in the library that maybe they don't know about?
Well, the library is really looking to help people who are perhaps looking for ways to, feed their families or for new ideas, but also for resources because, groceries are expensive. How do you make your food budget go farther? How do you make sure you're feeding your family healthy food? How do you find food? Food insecurity is unfortunately a real challenge in our community. So we have a lot of programs and services that are available for people. We have this great grant through the National Library of Medicine that gives us funds for health and wellness programs here. So we do healthy eating and healthy greens. We also do movement and mindfulness with a moment of reflection, and that talks about healthy eating and healthy lifestyle. I also want you to know that part of the library trying to help people that may be facing food insecurity is that we have a bi-weekly food distribution from our Barber Street Library, which is located in the Unity Plaza.
That's so awesome.
It really is pretty special. For those that are looking to be in the food service industry, we also do things like ServSafe classes for safe food handling.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So we help people on their career paths. Being able to enter the food service industry is a really good way for people to establish job experience and to obviously earn income, but you need a food service handling license or certification, which we offer for free, and for managers and also for people that want to be bartenders and need safe handling for alcohol and mixology. So a lot of food-related things for whether it's an aspiring baker or a home cook looking to make nutritious meals for their families, or people looking to enter this as a career, we've got a little something for everybody.
Bridget, thank you so much for helping me spread the word about the Library of Things, because sometimes people, maybe they don't know about that. They think the library is just for books and help with tax forms and things like that, but it's so much more.
It is so much more. Yes, come check out the Library of Things.
Literally, check out the Library of Things. That was Bridget Quinn from the Hartford Public Library. Now, not every library has a Library of Things, and every collection is different. Some even include seed libraries, so you can grow your own food. Ask your local librarian what's available. and call ahead or go online to find out what the library's rules are about borrowing items in their collections. I'm Robin Doyon Aiken. Seasoned is produced by me and
Meg Dalton,
Catrice Claudio,
Stephanie Stender,
Tegan Engel,
Meg Fitzgerald,
Scout Raimondo,
Sabrina Herrera,
Francesca Fontanez, Martha Castillo, and Shanice Rule are on our social team as well. Catch this and past episodes of Seasoned about delicious things like chocolate, olive oil, ice cream, apple cider, honey, and maple syrup wherever you get your podcasts. And subscribe so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Coming up on our next episode, we are celebrating Earth Day. So we'll have conversations with a local farmer, the author of Veg Forward, Susan Spungen, and the founder of Beekeeping While Black. Don't miss it.